Hey, welcome to the show. This is John Wheeler, and you're listening to episode number 40 of This Week in Nuclear, which was recorded December 22nd, 2006. On this podcast, I focus on the peaceful use of nuclear energy to make our world cleaner, safer, and less reliant on fossil fuels. And in this show, I'm going to focus on the USA-India nuclear cooperation deal, including allegations from factions within both the USA and in India that the deal should be killed. On December 18, 2006, President Bush approved the agreement, House Resolution 5682, which is officially called the Henry J. Hyde United States-India Peaceful Atomic Energy Cooperation Act of 2006. If you've been listening to my podcast for a while, you'll be familiar with the background of the deal. As early as last winter, there was discussion going on at diplomatic levels between the USA and India. And at the time, I found it interesting that the press in India was reporting on it while their American counterparts were totally ignoring the story. It didn't hit the radar screen in the USA until President Bush's visit to India this July. Then the American media woke up and realized there was something going on. During that visit, Indian Prime Minister Singh and President Bush signed an agreement to pursue nuclear cooperation. When Bush returned to the USA, the proposal was sent to Congress to consider and to draft into legislation. The agreement required a change to U.S. law because of conditions in the U.S. Atomic Energy Act of 1954 that specifically banned nuclear trade and cooperation with other nations unless they had signed the International Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And India never has. In fact, the USA cut off nuclear technology transfer with India in 1974 after they detonated an atomic bomb. Here's a summary of what's in the new agreement. By the way, I downloaded a copy of the bill, H.R. 5682, to my website and put a link in the show transcript, so you can go there and take a look at the entire document if you'd like to. I also highlighted some sections of the bill that continue to create political turmoil, and I'll talk about those in a few minutes. The U.S.-India Nuclear Cooperation Agreement allows the USA to share civilian nuclear equipment, technology, and expertise with India. This means that U.S. companies will be able to build reactors in India, and they'll be able to sell nuclear fuel for civilian nuclear plants. In addition, U.S. companies will be able to provide nuclear-related services to India's nuclear energy production facilities. This could represent billions of dollars of business for U.S. companies. In fact, there have already been at least two groups of industry and political leaders to visit India in recent weeks, scouting for potential new business. If you listened to episode 39, you heard Rudy Giuliani mention that he'd recently visited India with one such group. In exchange for opening the doors for U.S. nuclear technology, India has agreed to several changes in the way they handle their nuclear business. First of all, they agreed to separate their military nuclear assets from their civilian nuclear plants to ensure that no technology that's transferred from the USA makes its way to military use. India also agreed to open their civilian nuclear plants to assessments and intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. India will also continue their moratorium on atomic weapons testing, and they're going to strengthen the safeguards of their nuclear weapons arsenal. The USA and India both agree to work together to establish a joint ban on the production of additional fissile material for weapons. And finally, India agreed to prevent the spread of enrichment and reprocessing technologies to states that don't possess them and to support international non-proliferation efforts. The deal is drawing fire from Communist Party members in India who claim that the deal will weaken India's sovereignty and will make them unable to represent their own interests in foreign policy. Liberals in India claim that the deal creates a situation that will subject them to too much U.S. scrutiny. In the USA, the deal is being criticized by two Democratic Party officials, Edward Markey of Massachusetts and Tom Harkin of Iowa, who claim that it undercuts international non-proliferation efforts and rewards India for failing to sign the non-proliferation treaty. Markey, who's a frequent contributor at the anti-nuclear group, the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, claims that President Bush's signing statement undermines congressional oversight authority and violates the separation of powers between the legislative branch and the executive branch. And before I discuss Markey's claims, and there might actually be something to what he's saying, I want to talk about what happens from here on to put the agreement in motion. Before the actual sharing of nuclear technology can take place, a few things have to happen. First, the USA has to get the Nuclear Suppliers Group, a collection of nations who possess nuclear enrichment and reactor technology, to make an exception and allow trade with India. That sounds easy, but in light of the ongoing tensions with Iran and North Korea about their nuclear programs, the USA is already being accused of a double standard in the Middle East. In the end, the Nuclear Suppliers Group will allow the exception because those nations want a piece of the pie too. Russia, an NSG member, in fact, is already supplying India with fuel for its reactors. The NSG is scheduled to meet in April to discuss the proposal. Next, India's parliament will have an opportunity to debate the agreement. Unlike in the USA, though, it does not have to pass a vote in the parliament. The debate will give members with dissenting opinions the opportunity to air their differences, which the prime minister will take into consideration. Finally, the International Atomic Energy Agency has to inspect India's civilian nuclear facilities and deem them safeguarded to prevent proliferations of weapons capable of materials and technologies. I have no idea how long all this will take, but I suspect it won't be that long, perhaps several months to a year. In the meantime, I expect U.S. and Indian companies to begin the process of negotiating deals for nuclear services, materials, and technology. And here's an interesting thought in that regard. All the focus has been on the technology and materials flowing from the USA to India, but with the pending talent shortage in the USA and the growing business of offshoring services to India and elsewhere, what would prevent the U.S. companies from outsourcing engineering work for new nuclear plants to Indian companies? My guess is someone will figure out how to do that and make it happen. Now I want to discuss President Bush's signing statement and allegations by Representative Edward Markey. But first, some legal background on the situation. When a U.S. president signs a bill, he has the opportunity to make a signing statement. A signing statement is a written pronouncement issued by the president when signing a bill into law. Sometimes they're political or rhetorical in nature, but sometimes signing statements are used by presidents to issue interpretations of law. The first president to use a signing statement was James Monroe, so they've been around for more than a century. Prior to the first term of President Ronald Reagan, there had been only 74 signing statements issued. But beginning with President Reagan and through the current day, the issue of signing statements has increased dramatically. There have been more than 270 issued through Presidents Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and now George W. Bush. The current President Bush has issued more than 130 signing statements with challenges or interpretations to more than 800 federal laws. When President Bush signed H.R. 5682 earlier this month, he issued a signing statement with it that made specific mention of several conditions that Congress had added to the bill to strengthen congressional oversight. By the way, I have a copy of the signing statement on my website, and there's a link in the show notes so that you can take a look at it for yourself. It's less than a page long, so it's not tough to get through. If you read Section 103 of the new bill, you'll find that it's titled, quote, Statements of Policy, and it consists of about 2 pages of U.S. foreign policy statements that the Congress wrote related to nuclear energy and nonproliferation. In his signing statement, the President stated that his approval of the bill did not construe adoption of the policies described in Section 103. The reason? Constitutionally, the responsibility and authority to develop and implement foreign policy rests in the executive branch, not with the Congress. I'm not a constitutional attorney, but the President seems to have a point on this case. Next, the bill makes the USA-India deal contingent on the approval by the 45-member Nuclear Suppliers Group, and the President took exception to that statement. His basis for disagreeing is that provision would, in effect, turn foreign policy decisions of the USA over to an international group, something that's contrary to the Constitution. Again, foreign policy is the responsibility of the executive branch of government. As such, the president said he would consider the provisions of the bill to be advisory in nature. Finally, the bill contains several sections that require the president to periodically report specific information to Congress regarding India's compliance to the terms of the agreements. The president stated that because he has the constitutional responsibility to protect information that could damage national security, he would take the release of that information under consideration of the constitutional authority he has to protect and control information that would impair foreign relations, national security, the deliberative processes of the executive, or the performance of the executive's constitutional duties. What all that means is that he may not choose to provide Congress with that information if he deems it would impair foreign relations or national security. So it's easy to understand why Representative Markey takes exception to the president's signing statement. He and Tom Harkin worked to place those conditions in the bill to strengthen their ability to oversee foreign policy and to monitor India's compliance with the agreement. And the president has stated that he doesn't necessarily need to comply with those terms. As I mentioned before, this is nothing new between the president and Congress, but it might open the door to legal challenges in the future if the president deviates from the letter of the law. So why all the fuss? Well, India, like China, has a rapidly growing economy that's starving for energy. If predictions are right, then India's market for new nuclear plants could be on the order of 20 to 30 new plants in the next 25 years. That's a $60 billion market, and the U.S. companies want to be at the front of the line. There's also 14 civilian nuclear plants in India that need fuel, parts, and nuclear services, and that could add billions more in business. From a political perspective, India and the USA are the world's two largest democracies, and the US wants to do everything possible to strengthen relations and help India be successful. Also, you've heard me say it before, if the USA doesn't supply these goods and services, then somebody else will. Russia, Germany, France, Japan, and others are all lining up to compete for India's energy market. India has a lot to offer as well. An educated workforce, a well-established nuclear program, and huge deposits of thorium. One company, Thorium Power Limited, is already exploring potential business ventures in collaboration with partners in India. Well, that wraps it up. I hope you enjoyed this episode of This Week in Nuclear. And I hope I provided you with some information to highlight key aspects of the United States and India nuclear cooperation bill. Overall, it represents huge opportunities for both countries, but along with it come political and foreign relation risks that need to be well managed. Thanks for listening to the show. I want to remind you that you can leave me a voicemail at area code 206-984-3654. And you can listen to the show by cell phone by calling the number 510-248-0360. These are free services in that you only have to pay what you normally would for the calls. There's no charge for either leaving a voicemail or listening to the podcast by cell phone. I'd really like to play some voicemails on the air, so if you're thinking about sending me an email, how about trying the voicemail line instead? Well, this is John Wheeler. Thanks for listening to the show. Wishing you all a happy Hanukkah, a Merry Christmas, and a peaceful and prosperous New Year. Good night.